You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Mireya Solis, Senior Fellow and holder of the Knight Chair in Japan Studies here at Brookings. And I want to welcome you this morning to this event on Abenomics and its impact on the Asian economy. And I would like to say that this is a very timely event. The government of Japan released a new version of the growth strategy just last week. And I think there's a clear understanding that it is a growth strategy, the third arrow, the structural reform, which is really the critical component that will actually determine whether this economic revitalization strategy succeeds or not. And I think it's also fair to say that last year when the Japanese government released the first version, just exactly 1 year ago in June, there was a lot of skepticism as to whether the government could really undertake these broad range of structural reforms and really confront so many vested interests. So I think the question that we have upon us today is to really examine what has been put on the table in the second version. Can the government of Japan now offer an attractive program for undertaking these economic revitalization reforms? And I think it's also a unique event in the sense that we're going to be hearing today about something that usually does not come up in the discussion, and that is how will Abenomics affect the Asian economy? Given that Japan plays such a central role in this region through the global supply chains, through investment, through economic assistance, through financial flows, clearly how Japan performs economically will also affect these Asian economies. And I think we have a wonderful speaker to address these two issues. We have Dr. Naoyuki Yoshino. He actually has been a very influential advisor to the Japanese government. He contributed to these revisions to the second growth strategy. And because he is now the dean of the Asian Development Bank Institute, he's also clearly aware of how Japan plays a very important role in the Asian economy, and he'll share his insights with us on those issues. I should also mention that Professor Yoshino is also Professor Emeritus at Keio University, and he has had a very distinguished academic career with appointments both in Japanese and American universities, and he has played a key role in influential government committees. For example, he served as chairperson of the Ministry of Finance's Council on Foreign Exchange and Fiscal System Council. Now, I also want to introduce our discussant for this morning, a very distinguished economist, Dr. Eswar Prasad, who now holds the New Century Chair in International Economics at Brookings, and is also the Tolani Senior Professor of Trade Policy at Cornell University. And just to give you a sense of the range and impact of Dr. Prasad's career, I should mention that in the past, he was also head of the IMF's China Division. So we have really an excellent lineup this morning for you, a very timely and unique topic, Abenomics and its impact on the Asian economy. And I'd like to ask Dr. Yoshino to please come to the podium and start his presentation. Thank you.
Good morning. I was just introduced. I arrived this morning to Washington Dulles Airport, and I hope I can wake up. Today, I would like to talk about Abenomics and what is going on and what are the remaining factors we have to solve in Japan and whether the recovery will continue or not. Those are the main issues I would like to discuss today. Many people know there are three arrows of Abenomics. The first one is aggressive monetary policy, and this set up the target of 2% of inflation, and that is very different from previous monetary policy. And I know former governor Mr. Shirakawa very well, and I know Mr. Kuroda too. The two governors are very different in their character. Former governor Shirakawa is just like academic economist. So in the press conference, when he's asked about questions, he always talk about good scenario and bad scenario. But Mr. Kuroda only talks about good scenario. So that influences a lot for media people. And Mr. Kuroda does not follow any bad scenarios. And that is one. First one is monetary policy, setting up the 2% of inflation. This is the first time. However, the inflation targeting sometimes create problems in Japanese economy. It happened late 1980s. Rate of inflation of Japan was almost 0% in late 1980s. Because our Japanese yen had been appreciated a lot since 1985. And Central Bank of Japan was also looking at CPI or inflation rate. And they thought Japanese monetary policy is all right because inflation was very stable late 1980s. However, stock price and land price climbed up. So personally speaking, inflation targeting is one of the variables central bank should watch. However, Japanese exchange rate fluctuations significantly affect inflation of Japan. That has to be taken into account. And second arrow is fiscal consolidation. Many people know Japan has the highest debt to GDP ratio in the world. And we have to consolidate these fiscal budget deficits. And third one is growth strategy. And many people think first arrow is very easy to start. However, second and especially third arrow takes time. So many criticism comes to the third arrow is very slow. Yes, of course, because third arrow includes structural changes of Japanese economy. And since Prime Minister Abe came into power, this is the business conditions index captured by survey of major companies. Then you'll see the trend is recovering very quickly. In one sense, Prime Minister Abe was very lucky when he came into the office. Japanese yen started to be depreciated when he came into power. That was not necessarily by his policy, but he was very lucky. The reason of Japanese depreciation since last year came from the Europe and United States. Up until last year, Europe had some uncertainty about their fiscal policy, especially Greece, Italy, and Spain. Then last fall, EU has stepped in to consolidate those fiscal turmoil. And US economy was also uncertain until last year. And many countries, EU and USA, introduced quantitative easing policy, QE policy. So lots of liquidities are floating around in the world. And they are looking for the place to invest. And there are only four international currencies, US dollar, euro, British pound, and Japanese yen. Then huge liquidity are looking for the place to invest. And European economy was uncertain, US economy was a little bit uncertain, and British economy was the same. So yen was the only currency those quantitative easing were looking for. If China were open their exchange rate and capital, then much more money would have been gone to renminbi, Chinese currency. Then Chinese exchange rate would have been appreciated. But China is still controlling its capital, so all the money came into Japan up until last year. And when Prime Minister Abe came into power, the first arrow was announced. That means Japanese Central Bank will keep low interest rate policy until 2% inflation target will be achieved. So that has shifted the interest of Japan from overseas. And European uncertainty has been settled down, and U.S. economy started to gradually to recover. So all the money which came into Japan started to go back to their own territory. That has depreciated Japanese yen. And inflation targeting of 2% was the first time central bank set it up and announced. This has created a huge forward-looking policy. So many companies are looking for the monetary policy will continue to be eased until 2% will be achieved. So they are very much confident quantitative easing, QE policy, will last for a while. And expectations of the general public had been drastically changed. Yen started to depreciate, and that has created a good impact for export-oriented industries. However, we have another difficulty for the yen depreciation. After the tsunami and Fukushima nuclear accident, Japan has to rely on huge amount of energy on oil and natural gas. The price of those natural gas and oil started to go up because Japanese yen had been depreciated. So that is pushing up the costs for the manufacturing industries and also households. So depreciation of yen looks good for export-oriented sectors. However, the oil price are rising steady. And when Japanese yen has started to depreciate, many overseas investors started invest into Japan, especially for stock market. And engine of the growth of stock price came from overseas investors first. And that has created a very good recovery of stock prices. And at the same time, Japanese government introduced number 6, Nippon Individual Savings Account, which deducts the interest and dividends for individual investors up to 1 million yen for 5 years. That also has encouraged Japanese individuals comes into the stock market. And in past 20 years, Japan had been suffered economic recession. And one of the causes, I think, came from international rule, especially Basel capital requirement. Basel I, which was established in 1988, was set up 8% of the capital for all the financial institutions who are internationally operating. And there was no discretion for country by country. Because in those days, international rule was set up identical to all the countries. However, my estimates show that is wrong. Basel capital requirement should be different from country to country. That is one. Secondly, whether a country is facing with recession or boom, the capital requirement should be different. And this is my estimates for Japan. Optimal capital requirement rule should have been 8% minus 2.2%. So in Japanese case, 5.8% should have been the optimal Basel capital requirement ratio rather than 8%. And this high capital requirement ratio discouraged Japanese banks to lend money. That is called credit crunch in Japan. And similar thing can be seen for U.S. When the U.S. economy was in the boom and peak, their capital requirement ratio should have been 8 plus 4.42%. So when the economy is boom, the capital requirement should be increased. And in recession, it should be lowered. And Canadian banks are very much oligopolized, so their capital requirement ratio is almost okay, all right, about 8%. But international rules should have been much more rigorous. And in this Basel III, adopted part of my recommendation for counter-cyclical buffer for their new rule. And next, I'd like to talk about the monetary policy. Many American economists and the overseas economists, including Paul Krugman, was talking about Japan as in liquidity trap. And many people are focusing on monetary policy. However, Japanese biggest problem comes from aging population. And monetary policy cannot do anything about aging population. So in the past 20 years, many economists are focusing on monetary policy as if it can deal with aging population. But we now realize it is not, it was not. So we need structural reform. Okay. And another weak point of Japan is we are lack of global asset managers. Many financial institutions have asset management section. However, close to 90% of them are focusing on Japanese market, Japanese financial market, stocks and bonds. And probably less than 10% of Japanese financial institutions are focusing on overseas asset allocation. In order to do good overseas investment, probably there are 6 or 7 points asset managers has to focus on. First one is political situation of each region and monetary policy of various countries and liquidity of bank loans and so on. And asset managers has to see entire world from the top rather than looking at from Japan. Many asset managers of Japanese are looking at other countries from Japan rather than looking at from top of the globe. Then their way of thinking is very different. And best one is number 5. First, asset management should focus on which region they should invest. Then which country and which sector and which company. Those are the process how good asset management should be performed. But many Japanese asset managers starting from the company and rather than looking at from the global aspect. And also many good asset managers in overseas visit those countries by themselves to see the fluctuations of the economy. And they have to know the people whom they should ask questions. And this is a little bit technical, but monetary policy comes from this LM curve. And Professor Paul Krugman and many famous American economists are talking about Japanese monetary policy. Japanese economy was in liquidity trap. And they are talking about horizontal LM curve. But my observation of Japanese economy is not coming from money market, LM curve. It comes from IS curve. I'm talking about the vertical IS curve. Vertical IS curve means even if the interest rate becomes low, companies do not invest. That was a Japanese symptom in the past 20 years. Japanese companies kept on investing overseas, not in Japan, but other Asian countries. So even if interest rates were lowered, those companies do not invest within Japan. So IS curve became vertical. And investment has shifted from Japan to other Asian countries. So this IS curve shifted to the left. And monetary policy has been eased, so LM curve shifted to the right. So the result is from point A to point B. Lower interest rate and lower real GDP. So I think the Japanese problem was coming from investment and IS curve, rather than monetary policy and liquidity trap. And this question was asked at the final examination of macroeconomics in University of Hong Kong about 6 years ago. All of a sudden, I received many emails from Hong Kong. I was wondered why I'm asked so many questions. Then one professor read my paper, and they put the questions whether IS curve is vertical or LM curve or liquidity trap is a Japanese problem. So many students asked me. So I said, I'm correct. And other professors are wrong. That was my answer. Then Prime Minister Abe, again, the 3 arrows, monetary policy, targeting inflation for 2%. And the exchange rate has been very much affected by external factors, U.S. economy and euro. That's why Japanese yen had been appreciated and started to depreciate again. And fiscal consolidation, currently Prime Minister Abe is talking about increase of tax rate, consumption tax rate, T. But he should talk about government spending and tax revenue all together simultaneously. That is missing currently by Prime Minister Abe. Japanese social welfare and pension system is close to Europe. Sweden, VAT is 24%. I think Germany, 19%. Japanese VAT is 5%, which just raised to 8%. So if Japan prefers lower VAT, then government spending should have been lowered. And if we prefer European-style social welfare, then tax has to be increased. So Prime Minister Abe should talk to the general public. We have to think about, Japanese has to think about government spending and tax revenue as a simultaneous equation rather than either G or either T. And growth strategy, there are four growth strategies so far. One is reduction of corporate tax rate. If my explanation of vertical IS curve is correct, then reduction of a corporate tax rate will not encourage investment in Japan. Because even if the cost of capital becomes lower, Japanese companies do not invest. However, the reduction of corporate tax will encourage foreign companies to come into Japan. And that will accelerate competition within Japanese market. So I think the reduction of corporate tax rate will not encourage Japanese investment. However, the overseas investors becomes very easy to come into Japan. That can enhance competition within Japan. And we are facing with aging population. So female participation in the labor force 3-3 is very important, especially child care will be a very important issue. And number four is how to utilize old people. And I was joking to Prime Minister Abe that there are robots, so many robots are produced, so that could substitute the muscles of old people. And he also talked about number four last week. So development in robots can compensate for the old participation into the labor market. Next, I'd like to talk about asset allocation of households. There are three charts here. Left-hand side is United States, and middle is Japan. Right-hand side is Germany. Red portion is a share of deposits. And pink portion is insurance and pensions. And black one is bond market. And left-hand side is stock market. So U.S. is very well balanced. Deposits, insurance pensions, and bonds and stocks. This picture made U.S. recovery is much quicker compared to Japan. Japan and U.S. accumulated non-performing loans by banks. You can see in the middle, Japanese banking share is 60%. So they have carried so much non-performing loans for so long. But on the left-hand side, the share of U.S. banking sector is very small. Furthermore, U.S. banks sold those loan assets by securitization to overseas. So their share of the non-performing loans became much, much smaller compared to Japanese case. And that made U.S. economy much, much quicker to recover. And Japan stayed very long by keeping those non-performing loans at the bank. And Japan now is trying to shift these deposit-oriented asset allocation into at least to German way. Germany is in between Japan and United States. Financial assets in Japan are mainly accumulated by old, aged people. Deposits, insurance, securities, and other assets. Those who are over 70 years or 60 years has huge amount of deposits, insurance, and securities. And they are mainly interested in principal guarantee and whether it is very easy to make deposits or withdraw money. So those are the main reasons many people choose financial institutions. If you look at the bottom, rate of return, very small. So probably many Westerners are interested in rate of return, but the Japanese people are interested in principal guarantee. So that means they want to just keep on making into the banking deposits. Because of this bad asset management, Japan's dividend interest receipt divided by income is the lowest among OECD countries. One is it is mainly focused on deposits. Secondly, asset management to overseas are not doing very well by Japanese asset managers. So our rate of return is the lowest. So that is affecting negatively to aged society because people in old age has accumulated their financial assets. However, the rate of return is very small, so they cannot consume so much. So we have to increase those rate of return in order to face with aging population. Because aged people has less income, they have to utilize their accumulated assets. And these are the population aging of Japan. Top part is the age over 65. And middle part is working population. Bottom is number of children. You can see in the top, over 65 is increasing drastically. Currently, about one third are over 65. And working population has become smaller and smaller. So GDP divided by per capita in Japan has diminished drastically. However, GDP divided by working population was not so bad. So the worst part of Japan is the retired people who are over 65 years of age. And that contributed a very low per capita GDP of Japan in these 20 years. So we have to make all these old people to work much longer. And wage rate has to be based on productivity rather than seniority wage system. And probably that can solve some of the problems Japan is facing now. Next topic is Japan's debt to GDP ratio and government debt. And Japan has accumulated the highest debt to GDP ratio. Japan is a top. And second one is Greece. Greece went into bankrupt. Third one is Italy. I hope there are no Italian, but Italy may be close to somewhere in shaky, and Portugal and Ireland. And why Japan has sustained so well despite this very high debt-to-GDP ratio? Japan debt are mainly held by domestic investors. Only 8% are held by overseas investors. On the other hand, Greece, domestic investors only 23%. And about 80% of their 77% are held by overseas investors. So that creates a big difference between Japan and other countries. Most of the debt are held by domestic investors. Okay. If I use a diagram again, the vertical axis is the issue of government bonds. And upward sloping curve is demand for government bonds. And in Japanese case, demand for government bonds are kept on increasing. So that means vertical axis is the interest rate. Interest rate was kept on falling down. And this is the interest rate of Japanese economy. So it is falling down. On the other hand, Greece, 77% of the owners of government debt are overseas investors. So overseas investors, if they face with crisis, then risk premium will be asked. And many of them start to fly away from Greece market. So demand curve shifts to the left. Then you can see the interest rate will climb up. And this is the Greece and Portuguese and European countries. So the Japanese stability comes from the demand is coming from domestic investors, and domestic investors prefer to buy government bonds. And I think that many Japanese financial institutions, and including pension funds, hold government bonds. That has stabilized Japanese government bond market. And one of the reasons is lack of long-term asset management, number one, in Japan. Many pension managers, asset managers, rotate once every 2 to 3 years. And lack of corporate bond market, many investors are investing into government bonds market. And our pension funds are not 401k type. So all the money has been let the government asset management companies decide rather than individual decision. Once Japan introduces identification number for individuals, it will be possible to introduce 401k style pension system. Because government can ask all the individuals their preference of safe assets and risky assets. That will make asset managers much easier to invest into risky financial market. So I think that shift from the current pension system to 401k system, introducing identification number for individuals, will be important. Then that will create self-responsibility of asset management by individuals. And Japanese compensation and bonus system also contribute to hold lots of government bonds. If some asset managers did very well, but their bonuses are very small. But if some asset manager made big mistake compared to others, then he will be criticized strongly. So there is asymmetry between good performance and bad performance. Then many people want to avoid risks, number three. And they are looking for benchmark. And they are only looking for, always looking for what other asset managers are doing. On the other hand, US is a performance-based salary. So I think Japan should introduce somewhat performance-based that could create better incentive for asset managers to diversify their assets. And because of these reasons, Japanese demand for government bonds were kept on increasing, and that stabilized Japanese bond market. Lastly, I would like to talk about two issues. One is how to provide risk capital, risk money, to many new sectors. I call it hometown investment trust funds. In Japanese, it is called Furusato Toshi Fund. And it was introduced about 10 years ago. And they started to invest into solar power, wind power, and many other small businesses and startup companies. The method is especially grown after Fukushima and tsunami accident. After the tsunami, many fishermen lost their boat, left-hand side. They already borrowed money from banks, so banks could not lend money to repair their boat. And these fishermen started to collect money by hometown investment trust funds. So they have repaired their boat and start to catch fish and returning those money to their investors. And similar hometown investment funds is wind power and solar power. And many individuals want to change their nuclear power into environment-friendly energies. And lots of amount of money is coming into wind power and solar power. And another interest is agriculture sector looks very traditional. However, last year, Ministry of Agriculture introduced leasing system of agriculture land. Many Japanese farmers are close to retirement, 60, 65, but they want to own their land, piece of land, as their own. But leasing system allows them to lend those land to young generation. And it started last year, and many youngers started to cultivate their agriculture land, and some of them started beans, some of the others started Japanese wine. And in order to create these new agricultural products, they need some amount of money. And banks are very reluctant to lend money to them because it's very risky. So hometown investment trust funds are contributing their new cultivation. And these are another small business borrowing. Left-hand side, shark fin, right-hand side is seaweed company. They also raised this money through hometown investment trust funds. And last one is SME, small and medium-sized enterprises. In Asia, it is dominated by SME. And there's an information asymmetry between large companies and SMEs. Top figure is large company. Bottom one is SME. If this line is above zero, they are relatively easy to borrow money. If they are below zero, they are difficult to borrow money. So you can see small businesses are almost always very difficult to raise their money from banks or capital market. But large companies are not. Large companies are only exception this period of Asian financial crisis and subprime loan crisis. But other times, they are relatively easy. But small businesses are always difficult to borrow money. The reason comes from information asymmetry between SME and lenders of financial institutions. So Japan has started to collect SME database through Credit Guarantee Corporation. And we have accumulated 14.4 million data, and every year it is increasing. Then it is a surprise we can start to look at econometric models, and it is possible to predict the default risks of various sectors in SME. So collecting a database of SME will make them to reduce their information asymmetry. And I'm now trying to do similar method to Thailand. I have a seminar next week, Thailand, then Indonesia in August, and we want to create this kind of SME database in order to make them much, much easier to borrow money. And this method will also encourage SMEs to do new businesses, and that will hopefully contribute to the growth of the Japanese economy. Because time is up, I would like to stop here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dean Yoshino, for a really interesting and comprehensive presentation. So now I'd like to ask Dr. Prasad to please share with us his reactions and responses to Dr. Yoshino's presentation.
Thank you, Maria, and good morning. That was a very enlightening presentation, so I'd like to structure my remarks in three or four dimensions. One is trying to think about the combination of policies under Abenomics, what was promised and what has been delivered so far and what has been intended by the Abe government to deliver. Second is the timing. Is it too late? As we know, the Japanese lost decade, some have argued, was the result of monetary policy that was constantly behind the curve, so where do things stand this time? And third, trying to think a little bit about whether it is too little or, as some have argued, too much, trying to do too many things on the structural front at the same time. And then fourth, I'll talk a little bit about the implications for the world economy and particularly the Asian region, where, of course, the Japanese economy, although having been overtaken in size by the Chinese economy, still remains very crucial to the region in terms of capital flows, in terms of trade flows, and so forth. So let's start with a combination of policies. Now, what was promised by Abenomics, of course, was a very ambitious set of policies. And I think there was a clear recognition that Japan had reached a stage in its growth where you could not work with just one set of policies. Now, the reality is that macro policies such as monetary policy and fiscal policy are a lot easier to put into train than structural policies, which invariably require a lot of political capital. But in Japan's case, of course, even fiscal policy is somewhat hamstrung by the very high levels of debt that Professor Yoshino talked about. So ultimately, it came down to monetary policy. Now, this is where things get interesting, because, of course, it's not just Japan, but a very large group of economies, both advanced economies, including the U.S., the Eurozone, and so forth, and a lot of emerging market economies, including my own India, where central banks have basically taken on the entire burden of supporting growth, maintaining inflation, either getting back up to a target range or bringing it back down to a target range, and trying to maintain financial stability. Now, a central banker, as we've learned, can credibly say, I will do whatever it takes, and the market seems to believe it. It's much more difficult for a politician to say, I will do whatever it takes, because there is a very large political price to be paid. But what Mr. Abe was trying to convince us was that if Mr. Kuroda could go in front of the public and say, I will do whatever it takes conditional on everything else being done the right way, then perhaps Mr. Abe's statement would have much more validity and credibility. The problem here, of course, was that the sequencing got a little out of whack, because we had monetary policy acting relatively forcefully early on, fiscal policy being somewhat hamstrung again for the reasons Professor Yoshino already mentioned, and then structural policy is lagging. So this comes to the entire issue of timing, whether in fact there is enough ammunition that Mr. Abe has in his cannons or in his quivers to be able to make structural policies effective at this stage. And the second issue, which this ties into, of course, is whether Mr. Abe is trying to do too much at the same time. Now, what I think Mr. Abe may have been using as a strategy is essentially to push things to a point where it was obvious that monetary policy had reached its limits. Despite all that the BOJ has done and has promised to do, Japan is only halfway towards its inflation target of 2%, with inflation running at about 1% at an annualized rate right now. Now, one might argue that this has already had pretty good effects, because if you look at the growth of the Japanese economy relative to many other advanced economies, Japan hasn't been doing too badly. In fact, there were a couple of quarters where Japan, among the major advanced economies, had by far the highest rate of growth at an annualized rate. But I think there is a clear recognition that this is not the sort of stable, balanced growth that will be enough to put Japan back on a trajectory towards sustained growth. So in that sense, the structural policies, I think the time has come, and what Mr. Abe seems to have promised is exactly the right sort of things that need to be done, dealing with the labor market, dealing with financial markets, dealing with corporate governance issues. And of course, the laundry list is very well known. Now, I think the big question that remains on the floor is whether Mr. Abe will really do whatever it takes. Because clearly, when it comes to issues like labor market reform, in terms of changing labor force participation by females, in terms of freeing up some of the rigidities in the labor market, it's going to extract a pretty large political toll domestically. And one might argue that Mr. Abe, early on in his term, might have had more of a clear mandate to push forward, but perhaps a different strategy is to say that the Japanese economy is really not going to get going, and there is a much broader understanding now of what needs to be done, so perhaps it made sense to wait. I am a little concerned that, in a sense, although a lot has been promised, it is coming a little late, but we'll have to wait and see whether, in fact, Mr. Abe puts his political muscle behind this. Now, one reality that Japan faces, of course, is that if this entire package doesn't have credibility, it's going to be very difficult to deal with the problems on aggregate demand that Mr. Yoshino referred to with his IS curve. Because ultimately, if firms don't have the confidence to invest, if consumers don't have the confidence to go out and consume, it's going to be very difficult to have a demand-led recovery in Japan. And again, the reality is with that the yen sticking around at about 101 or 102 to the dollar, it's going to be very difficult to generate an export-led recovery. And Japan still is an economy that very much relies on exports. And this is where the external environment becomes very complicated, because Japan still needs exports as a viable engine of growth, because it's hard to imagine especially given all the constraints on the supply side, which are going to take a while to get over, and also the constraints on the demand side, the lack of confidence that this economy can really get going without a somewhat weaker yen. And the question is whether the Japanese yen has reached a point where, despite more actions by the BOJ, it isn't going to move much further. And this is where regional dynamics become very important. And I think going around the Asian region, what I've heard increasingly is the sense that in many Asian economies, there is a big concern right now that the global governance mechanisms are not working very well. What we've learned from the global financial crisis and the volatility in capital flows as a result of the U.S. Announcement of its QE tapering, and then the flows that went back into Asia after the pullback of flows after the taper announcement, it's led to a large increase in capital flow volatility. And emerging markets in the region feel that they need a lot more protection. They don't feel that they can trust the IMF still, because, again, the IMF governance reforms are blocked. And what they face is a very complicated situation where, despite the QE tapering in the U.S., money is beginning to flow back in from the U.S., and this has been the case for the last 4 or 5 months, even to formerly vulnerable economies like India and Indonesia. The European Central Bank has indicated that it is going to move forward with quantitative easing, and many ECB members have made it abundantly clear that they want a weaker euro. China has made it very clear that it is not going to allow very large currency appreciation. Japan wants a weaker yen. So what does all of this mean? You're going to have a lot more capital flowing into Asian emerging market economies, which in turn are going to recycle that capital because they don't want their currencies appreciating and they want more safety. So there is going to be a search for safe havens. And despite all the problems in Japan, Japan is still regarded as a safe haven, especially by economies that don't want to entirely rely on the U.S. dollar as a safe haven currency. And the problem in Japan, of course, is that despite the very large amount of debt, you have relatively thin liquidity in the JGB market because, as Professor Yoshino pointed out, much of the JGBs that are outstanding are held by institutional investors, by domestic investors who actually don't trade a lot, and to a very limited extent by foreign investors. So relatively small amounts of money flowing into Japan can have fairly large effects at the margin in terms of what happens in the JGB market and in terms of the currency. So what I suspect is going to happen is that if the BOJ moves forward very aggressively with further monetary easing, that is going to push more capital out into the Asian region, which in turn is going to recycle back into Japan, thereby offsetting some of the attempts of the BOJ. And I think this is why structural reforms become really important, because I think both for the reason that Japan may be in something of a liquidity trap, second, ultimately monetary policy cannot deal with supply-side constraints, and third, there is going to be a recycling of capital from the Asian emerging market economies back into Japan that I don't see a way out of forceful structural policies. So this is a very interesting juncture for Japan at one level. There was a realization that unless Japan put in place forceful structural policies, the economy wasn't going to get moving. And finally, we seem to be seeing the third quiver, the third arrow from the quiver being unleashed. But how much force it's going to be unleashed with, how much there is going to be pressure behind that arrow if there is pushback from the other side, remains to be seen. So as with much else, I'm cautiously optimistic, but still somewhat worried.
Thank you so much, Ezra. That was terrific. And before I ask Dean Yoshino to briefly reply to these comments, I wanted to add just a few observations on three points. One is, of course, what ails the Japanese economy and what's the best approach to solve these problems? Second, what should be the best approach, the underlying philosophy, if you will, to economic reform? And third, Japan's role in the Asia economy. And my comments very much echo what Ezra was saying. I think I really found fascinating that you offered here a very novel interpretation about what is the root problem of Japan's economy, and that you offered, you know, these vertical IS as the central issue to be addressed. And if that is the case, I think it's very interesting that in the latest growth strategy that was just released last month, most attention really focused on the reduction in the corporate tax rate. And I think, Dean Yoshino, you told us that today, you told us that that is not going to address the issue of Japanese companies investing more in Japan. It will attract foreign direct investment, but it will not get Japanese companies to invest more. So I would like to ask if you see other elements of the growth strategy that could help entice Japanese companies to invest more. And if it's not there, what do you suggest be put on the table in the short or medium term to encourage this positive cycle of investment by Japanese corporations? My second point has to do with what should be the overriding philosophy or approach to economic reform. I think it's clear that there is no appetite whatsoever in Japan for shock therapy, but actually it's gradualism. And of course, it's very ambitious because, as you mentioned, the Japanese government is trying to really tackle so many areas. If you look at the areas of reform, it's really mind-blowing. It's healthcare, it's agriculture, it's labor market, it's integration in the world economy, and so forth. But the idea is that you have to move gradually because these are structural reforms that also require legislative action, and therefore they cannot be changed overnight. And to me, this Dino Chino offers a question I myself have no answers to, but I would like to pose it to you and see what you make of this. In the sense that many people, when they look at this gradualist approach, they only see policy capture. And they tend to make the argument that vested interests have captured the process and it's not going to go far enough. Other people tell us, no, actually, this is just one step out of many. And there's a real end goal in mind, and we just have to be patient because we'll get there. And so to me, this brings a question as to what is really the tipping point. When will we reach this cumulative effect that will really trigger this positive cycle of productivity enhancing, forceful structural reforms to be implemented? I quite frankly don't have an idea when I get asked this question as to what will be the turning point, the tipping point, when we can say Japan has crossed that milestone and we're really now in the path to productivity enhancing, growth sustaining economic reforms. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that, knowing that, of course, it's a very difficult question to answer. And the last one, I think that Ezra did a terrific job highlighting the regional dynamics and all these questions about excess capital looking for safe havens and perhaps how this actually then could put pressure on the Japanese yen to become to appreciate. I had a much more mundane, if you will, question about regional dynamics, and that has to do when you wear your cap as Dean of the Asian Development Bank Institute and you travel the region frequently and very broadly. What are Asian perspectives about Abenomics? Are they more optimistic, perhaps, than when we hear in the United States? Do they focus on different aspects that perhaps the discussion is here in the United States or in Europe? What is the perception about where Japan is heading and how can Japan contribute to Asia's development? So 5 minutes to all of that, please.
5 minutes, yes. I wish I had 50 minutes. As far as Abenomics are concerned by Asian people, there are two views. If it goes gradually, then many people are hoping Japanese economy will recover by shifting aggregate demand upward. So in order to do so, corporations has to start to invest more within Japan. And mainly, that may be focusing on old people, elderly people, because their generation is changing from younger to older. And many corporations in Japan focusing on young people, mm-hmm. in the past. But if old people keep on working and they have their own income together with their pension payments, then they will start definitely for consume. And that will become a huge market for Japan. And as far as GDP, aggregate supply and growth strategy concerned, there are three components for GDP. One is R&D, TFP part. And labor and capital. And labor, if old people start to participate into labor market, and if the female participation comes much more, then the labor market will become much more active. And technological progress, as I mentioned about hometown investment trust funds, and new those capital will come into the market, then there's a potential for boost the R&D. And about female participation in the labor market, I would like to give two interesting examples. University of Hokkaido in economics, they made job openings. And it says this position is available only for women. no man. So that is a surprise for my graduate student. He's a boy. He was very angry. Why it is just for female? And Financial Services Agency, FSA, which is a government financial regulation, this year, 50% of the new hiring was female. So I think in many companies, they are stressing female participation into the labor market. Then next step is child care will be very important for female. And if those systems will be introduced, currently child care costs a lot. But if we can introduce a much easier way, then probably that will help. Because there are many old, good ladies who wants to take care of their like grandchildren. Mm-hmm. But currently there are so much restrictions for those people to open their private nurse care. So I think that should be opened much more. And structural reform, and I think labor market will become much more competitive once old people start to work and female comes into the power. And how about export-oriented growth? I think I'm hoping the older generation can contribute some part of the consumption. And new investment will also come to take care of old people, because Japan is facing with aging population. China will become an aging population. Europe will follow. So if Japan can develop very good technological progress in those areas, I think Japan can regain exports to those countries. As far as Asian countries are concerned, I think China's exchange rate should be much more flexible, and capital control should be gradually improved. As you said, Japanese yen is a safe haven. If Chinese capital market were open, Chinese renminbi would be much bigger safe haven for other countries. And my dynamics econometric model for China is currently Chinese exchange rate to US dollar is about 0.85 weight. It used to be 1.00. The optimal value for Chinese renminbi to US dollar is 0.58. That is the optimal basket weight. And they should take 3 to 4 years to achieve those optimal basket. Then the Asian capital market and exchange rate market will drastically be changed. And capital inflow and outflow from various countries will become enhanced. And I'm very much concerned about QE policy, quantitative easing. 1997-1998, Asia were hit by financial crisis. That came from quantitative easing of advanced nations. So I think quantitative easing is mainly focused on their own countries by advanced countries, but there are lots of side effects. So if quantitative easing lasts a little bit longer, then that will change the oil price, commodity prices, and also the capital inflow into Asian region. And my student Farhada and I did empirical work about oil price and commodity prices. They are definitely affected by quantitative easing policy of advanced nations. And, okay, I hope I answered almost all of them.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much. That was wonderful. Now I want to open it for questions from the audience. So if you can please wait for the microphone and identify yourself and ask a concise question. I have a gentleman here. Frank, can you reach him?
Thank you. I'm Mike Billington. I'm with Executive Intelligence Review. One of your underlying themes is that Japan needs to be more like the U.S. and Europe in being encouraging higher risk and less of the guaranteed stability. And you seem to be looking at a recovery in the U.S. and stability in Europe. But even the BIS this last week released figures showing that the bubble in the West is now increasing at a greater rate than any time in history. Derivatives are now increasing at some 20% per annum, approaching $2 quadrillion in outstanding derivative debt in the Western banks. So this is heading for a crash of unprecedented proportions, and I think increasingly people recognize that. So Japan, you say, recovers more slowly than the West, but it also is more immune to such a crash because it maintains a commitment to long-term stable growth rather than risk. So I would ask you to respond to that, and perhaps also to the fact that the Eurasian countries, Russia, China, India, are going fully with infrastructure, big infrastructure, which is completely lacking in the West. And Japan, of course, could be a huge contributor to that, which is an avenue for, I think, the best kind of long-term real growth. So.
Okay. Thank you very much. Very good question. I have looked at the bubble and crisis in many countries, especially focusing on Japan, China, and the United States. I created 5 indicators to watch carefully. First one is loans to housing and real estate divided by total bank loans. And whenever we are facing with crisis, that is drastically increasing, U.S. and Japan. That is one indicator. Second one is growth rate of bank loans in comparison to growth rate of GDP. If bank loan, the growth rate of bank loan exceeds GDP growth rate in very high trend, then that will cause crisis. Third one is housing price divided by income. U.S. and Japan, we observe housing price to compared to income suddenly increased, and it came back to original level. That is the third indicator. And fourth indicator is the turnover ratio of stocks. And turnover ratio of stock market becomes very high in crisis period. And last one is many individual, unsophisticated individuals start to invest into stock market. That is the end of the crash. So that we observed in U.S. and Japan. So I'm looking at all those 5 indicators. And looking at some indicators are still not in critical point. So far, quantitative easing is not so much based on these 5 criteria. But if quantitative easing lasts a little bit longer, it may create all these 5 indicators becomes a very critical territory. And Russia, China, India, and exchange rate, I think I'm very much on the infrastructure. Infrastructure is quite required in Asian regions. However, there aren't any good assessment mechanism whether some kind of roads will be needed or another may not be needed. So I think a big research will be required to look at the performance of infrastructure investment. And financing, there are lots of private sectors started to invest into infrastructure investment in Asia. And public-private partnership, PPP, is growing. So I think that can partly contribute the performance of infrastructure and construction. However, we have to look at the efficiency of infrastructure investment.
What do you think of China's Asia Investment Bank?
I see. Okay, China's investment bank is related to their exchange rate. China has fixed exchange rate to U.S. dollar and Europe. So Central Bank of China keeps on accumulating U.S. dollar, euro, and Japanese yen. So they want to use those accumulated currencies for their development of their investment. So they invest a euro into European countries and Central Asia, and U.S. dollar to Africa and Asia, and so on. So the creation of those infrastructure investment bank comes from their fixed exchange rate, the accumulation of foreign currencies, and they want to use that foreign currency for those investments.
Great. So any more questions from the audience? Yes, Alan Wolf.
I'm Ira Wolf with Pharma in Tokyo. I don't understand what I mean, I agree with your comment about speed. I don't understand why everyone seems so hung up on the need for fast action in Japan. During the good days of Japan, we saw incredible growth, tremendous growth miracle after the war, but it was also slow and incremental. Today, I look at the pharmaceutical sector, which is the only thing I know about anymore about in Japan, and I see the beginning of significant structural change over the last 18 months. I don't know when the date is. I have the same question you have. I don't know whether we'll see the fruits in 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, but it's very clear the direction it's going. Friends in the energy sector, about which I know nothing, say the exact same thing. And I'm trying to find others in other sectors who observe that. So what's wrong? So what? As long as that structural change occurs, and it occurs in a stable way, which seems to be happening now, and this previous comment about does that also insulate you from the insanity of the rest of the world's macro and microeconomic policies? Any comment?
Okay. So maybe I should. I think that was sort of addressed to me. Unless you had something to say. My view about reforms is indeed that trying to undertake too many drastic reforms at the same time, especially in an economy, including one like Japan's, which is very complex and where there are many inefficiencies and rigidities in the system already, could lead to unanticipated, possibly not so positive effects. But history is important here, and I think in the case of Japan, one does worry a little bit about whether there will be enough political will to carry through these reforms. And that ultimately is what it comes down to, because when you speak about things like monetary policy, those are actions you can take fairly quickly and without much political resistance in countries where central banks are independent. But with big structural reforms, there are very powerful vested interests, as in the case in Japan and in most other countries. And the problem is these reforms do tend to get watered down over time. And my concern is that given that there isn't that much credibility yet that these reforms are going to be put in place, it's important perhaps at least to lay out a long-term plan, which Mr. Abe has done, and to provide some good down payments in the short term. So what we've seen over the last week from Prime Minister Abe is certainly what one would want, a framework, a clear sense of direction in terms of where one wants to go, and a down payment on reforms, because, again, one doesn't expect change overnight. But again, going back to the issue of history, in the case of Japanese monetary policy, there seems to be a general agreement that more forceful actions by the BOJ might have, if not prevented, at least alleviated Japan from having to go through the lost decades. So there was a sense that financial system problems were not acknowledged sufficiently early. Action wasn't taken sufficiently early. So it's in the context of that history that I make those comments. But I do certainly take the point that a raft of reforms being unveiled overnight is certainly not what one would want or desire.
I think Japan was always facing with problems at the first time as a front runner. Banking crisis came to Japan at the first compared to Europe and United States. And Japanese government in early 1990s tried to inject capital into the banking sector. However, many corporations and opposed it. Why do we have to save bankers? And when some company goes into bankrupt, government will never support. Then why should government support banking industry? That was a huge criticism against injection of capital into the banking sector. That delayed Japanese economy to recover, and also Basel capital requirement of 8%, identical to all the countries, also delayed our Japanese recovery because of credit crunch. So Japan was, in a sense, a front runner for various crises. And at the same time, Japanese recovery and also the shocks are always mitigated by gradualism. So I think growth strategy will take time, but if Prime Minister Abe's policy could be fully implemented, I think gradually the Japanese economy will come back to the normal route.
Thank you very much. Other questions from the audience?
Thank you very much. My name is Tayo Scanlon-Kimura. I'm with SAIS at Johns Hopkins. These questions are for Dr. Yoshino. I was wondering on the subject of collecting data on SME and Southeast Asian countries, are you traveling to Thailand and other countries as a representative of Japan? Is Japan leading the collection of those economic data? And also, will that be done on a country-by-country basis or the larger ASEAN community, which is expecting economic integration by 2015.
Thank you very much. Small and medium-sized enterprises are dominating in all of Asia, and they lack of how to finance SMEs. And as I mentioned, information asymmetry between SME and banks. So I think I'm doing it together with Japanese government and also ASEAN Secretariat and ADB all together. SME is a very big focus of attention in many countries. And there are many loan sharks, and many finance companies are charging very high interest rate for those SMEs because of lack of information. And first, I did it for Japan, and then Thailand, I already visited last year, and Indonesia, and going to Philippines and Malaysia, and entirely into all Asian nations. I would like to try the same method and exchange information. Thank you.
I think we have time for one more question. Okay, so I think that's what we have for today. We had a terrific discussion. Thank you, everybody, and please join me in thanking the panelists for today's discussion.
Thank you very much.